Welcome to That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by Scientific Triathlon and hosted by me, Michael Eriksson. Today's guest is Gabriele Gallo, who is returning to the podcast after first appearing in August 2024. So it's close to 2 years ago since we last spoke. Gabriele is the founder of Knowledge is What, where he covers the latest cycling performance research. So I suggest everybody listening go and follow him there on Instagram and on Substack if you're not already. And in today's episode, Gabriele and I will be doing a research roundup where we'll each bring a couple of recent studies that we've found interesting to the table. We'll discuss what they found and how to apply things to athletes, endurance athletes in practice. Gabriele, it's great to have you back on the show. How are you?
Yeah, hi, Michael. Thanks for the invitation. All good. All good. Thank you. And yeah, let's hope to give some useful insights and indications for your listeners.
Let's do it. Let's jump right in. If you want to start with the first study that you've selected, and if you can start and give a bit of a rundown of what it's all about.
Yeah. So the first study that I selected is like, I think it can be considered quite simple, but it can be a seminal study for the future, because I think it's proved something, not proved, but suggests something that can be very, very, very interesting. So the study is from Odden. I don't know if it is the right pronunciation, but it's a research group from Norway. The author is from Norway. And basically, they try to prove or to see if training responsiveness is repeatable at the individual level. So the research question was like, if you train in one way following one program for 8 weeks, what was the case for this study, and you do a period of the training and start again from the same baseline initial fitness level and repeat the same 8 weeks program, do you achieve the same physiological and performance aerobic adaptation? So the question was if training responsiveness is repeatable at the individual level, so within the same individual. So basically, 8 weeks training program, 8 weeks completely rest, and then repeating the same program and seeing what are the differences. And so one thing to consider is that the participants were untrained, so very low baseline fitness level, and their fitness level return again at the same level after the training before starting the second 8 week training period. So I think good study design to answer the question. And I think the results are very interesting, because if you look at the group level, so on average, the gains were similar after the first and the second period. So the variables considered were VO2max and some blood measure like hemoglobin.
15 minute time trial performance, power output for 15 minutes.
Yeah. So what was a bunch of aerobic performance and physiological variables to see the adaptations. So were similar between the two periods at the group level, but if you look at the individual level, there was I think the statistical right term is maybe it's poor relationship or no relationship at all. So it was not that the guys that improved more in the first period were the guys that improved more in the second period. So it's quite unpredictable, even in the same individual, same training program, the fitness response. So I think this is the main point of the study.
Yeah. You say guys, but actually I think that this one good thing about this study was that they had basically 50% roughly male and female athletes. So that was an interesting one. And yeah. And the training itself was, it was 3x45, or on average, at least some weeks they did 4, some weeks 2, but basically 3 weeks, 3 sessions per week, 45 minutes of some sort of intervals, either some kind of, you could call it threshold intervals, or the classic 30-50 in the VO2 max intervals. And then they also had 4x5 minute intervals where the goal was to go at maximum intensity, and they use that to then progressively overload and adjust the power targets for the other workouts. So yeah, I think it was, like you said, a very good study design. I guess, what are your first thoughts and your what do you take away from that study personally?
Yeah, so I think my first thought when I read it is to connect it to the famous fitness fatigue models. You know that many software as a fitness fatigue form or whatever is called model, trying to predict outcomes based on the inputs, where the input is depends on the software, but is training load or training intensity or training volume or combined both in load. And my take is, if this study shows that it's not repeatable, the response, how can such a model predict future performance? So I think this study largely challenged most of the fitness fatigue models as are presented and as are done now in many commercial softwares to exactly predict performance at a future point. So this was my first connection when I read the study.
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, I think that's. I mean, it's weird because it's a bit implied rather than said explicitly with those models that they don't exactly say that just because you have more training load that you'll get more performance. But I think there's certainly an implication, and a lot of athletes understand it as such. And yeah, this is an example of where that might not be the case. I think I really today, before a couple of hours ago, I was digging into this, and I've read this study before, and sort of just got into it with even just looking at the title of it. It's called Limited Reproducibility of Individual Physiological Adaptations to Repeated Endurance Exercise Training. It's good in exercise science that the title basically tells you everything what a study is about and also what it finds in many ways, because it makes it easy to decide whether a study is relevant for you to read or not. But one thing that is maybe bad is that it leads you to, almost before you read it, to have a certain opinion and a certain bias. And I think I definitely came into this when I first read it with that bias that, okay, they did find limited reproducibility. But then now, today, when I read it for the second time, I actually thought that, I don't know, I don't know if I even agree that, or at least to the extent that there is limited reproducibility, because if you look at the stats of it a bit, for example, for the 15-minute time trial power output, on average, the participants improved by 17 watts in the first period of training and 22 watts in the second period. So that was about 15 to 16% improvements, because let's remember, these were untrained people. They were not very fit to start with. So it was actually very big, or not very big for untrained people, but big improvements, good improvements. They really, on average, had good improvements. But then when you look at the individual data and the chart, the lines going from so-and-so participant improved by 10 watts in period one and 30 watts in period two, and another improved by 20 watts in period one and 15 in period two, or 30 watts in period one and 20 watts in period two, those sorts of stats led to the poor statistical correlations, which were indeed very poor. But I'm not sure if I would necessarily say that in practical terms it means that that there was poor reproducibility, because I think most participants still improved by a certain amount in both training periods. But it wasn't that they always improved by one. Participant A improved by, or Joe improved by 10 watts in both periods, and Alice improved by 20 watts in both periods. Like, there was a variation there. But I think that's what I would expect in humans doing training, because it's humans, it's not robots. So yeah, I get that statistically it means poor reproducibility, because if the reproducibility was good, then the person that gets the best response in period one should also get it in period two. But in practice, when looking at the individual data, I just think that it means that we cannot know exactly what the reproducibility is, but still from my perspective, I look at it and see that in both training periods, most of these athletes improved by a certain amount. So that was maybe my second take when I read it the second time, I guess, or going almost a bit against the conclusion of the study. What do you think about that?
Yeah. I see your point of view, but I agree more with the raw title of the study. So I think it's still valid because I think that what you just said, that they improved differently, but you say they still improve, so it's okay. I think it is related to the fact that they were untrained participants. So I think with very low fitness level, starting level, not training before entering the first 8 week period. So I think it's natural that they improve after both the first and second period. But I think that specifically in this sample is good analysis that they compare the exact percentage improvement, not just if improved yes, no, or decrease, but looking exactly at the improvement, because for me, it's just natural that they all improve because of their very low fitness level and no training history.
I don't know. I'm not critical of the study per se. I just think that it depends on what your expectation is for how reproducible a program should be. Like, do you expect, like, when I first saw the title, for example, the first time I saw the study, I thought that maybe half of them didn't improve at all in one of the periods. So they maybe didn't improve in period one and then improved in period two and vice versa. But that wasn't really the case. So that's maybe more what I'm thinking, that it was more clustered around certain levels of improvement than I would have expected just initially seeing the title, I guess.
I think that the title is strong, but in line with the, I think, good statistical approach and study design. But I think that one thing that they highlighted and is that did not control for anything outside training, generally speaking. For example, hours. What did they do outside training, and how did they eat, and their stressor outside training? And I think that's a very, it's not a weak point of the study, but it's a thing that we can consider for the interpretation. So training response to the same training program is not so predictable when you don't control anything outside training. So my point is that many things outside training can impact training responsiveness.
Yeah, absolutely. Even something like, so the whole protocol for any given individual was 24 weeks, 8 weeks period one, 8 weeks of detraining, and 8 weeks period two. So what is the impact of maybe doing period one in the spring, in cool weather, and period two in the middle of the summer when it's warm? Like, we don't even know what the lab looked like, if they had a small fan, and maybe we have somebody with a really high sweat rate, and maybe a bigger person that is building up a lot of heat. So even those sort of things could impact things in one or two ways. Maybe they get an extra stress because of the heat, and that gives more adaptation, or they actually struggle because of the heat and they improve less in period two. So that's an example of a factor as well with a fairly long protocol like this, that the time of year could have an impact. We don't know this because they didn't say actually if they have a super well climate controlled lab that it could well be, but it wasn't clear. And another, there are lots of good points, I think, in the study, absolutely. So one thing that they said is that that basically you cannot expect the same result every time you repeat a training protocol, and for that reason they suggested that it's important to try to optimize group level training rather than focusing too much on the individual response, because basically just because you don't respond so well once to that great group level program, you might still respond great the second time you do it. So that was a good point that they made in the discussion part, I think.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that is in line. I think it's Heraclitus, the philosopher, that say that the same man never passed the same river twice, because the man is never the same, and the river is never the same again. So I think that summarizes well this study. But again, I think this is strong related to also not just that training adaptations are not just related to the exact same training program, but how generally your body is in a responsive or not responsive state in a certain period. And that can be related also to factors outside training. For example, the general emotion and psychosocial stress that you are, especially in this design with untrained and unprofessional athletes, it could have changed. And the author said that the scenario outside training, it could have changed a lot. So I think that's a point. And that is a thing that also I'm very interested in, like connecting something between, I don't know what is the English term, but neurology, psychology, and endurance training, to see how these affect training adaptations. So, for example, there was also, I think, a good paper by John Kelly about this thing, but how emotions during training and everything about psychology affect your biological state during and after training, and how this environment influence molecular molecular biology for endurance adaptations like PGC1-alpha adaptations, mitochondria, and whatever.
Yeah, sort of along the lines of the biopsychosocial model of performance, I guess, or that's what it sounds like.
Psychobiological.
But yeah, no, I think one question for you: what do you think how do you think the results would have changed, if at all, if we would take not professional level athlete, but sort of decent amateur athletes, maybe VO2 max of around 50, 55 instead of 35, which I think they had on average in this study? How would things have changed?
Yeah, I think it is very, very interesting questions. And actually, I think the follow-up study should be like dividing in two groups and redoing the analysis between untrained and trained experience, not necessarily professional, but well-trained athletes. But I think that generally speaking, I would say less, more reproducibility compared to this kind of guys and girls. And again, I think that more and more we go higher with the level of training history and fitness, I think it can be changed, the trend observed in this study. For example, in real world, let's use the term real world environment, everything is much more standardized outside training. So also professional athletes are much more better and much more familiar with standardizing everything outside training to have the best outcome for the training plan. So everything is around good sleep, good recovery, and good nutrition to focus only in training. While in this kind of study design and participant, everything can be, but that was also the point of the authors of the study. Everything can be messed up outside training, and this can influence training adaptations. And I think that's a point also for time-crunched amateur athletes. It's not only about training, is suggesting this study.
Yeah, for sure. That's a takeaway that we can take. And because like we said, most of these athletes, they did improve both times, but there were some relatively big differences. Like it could be that you improved 10 watts the first time and 25 watts the second time. So that's a big difference, right? And it was the exact same program, the exact same starting fitness for the same athlete. So something outside of training must have had a pretty big impact. And so it does highlight how important those things are when the training was the exact same. We've got some big news from our good friends at Precision Fuel Hydration. They have been announced as the title sponsor of the 2027 Ironman 70.3 World Championship that will take place in Chattanooga on the 28th and 29th of August. A lot of you listening will be chasing a slot, and as you probably know, August in Chattanooga means heat and humidity, so your fueling and in particular hydration strategy can make or break your race. This is where Precision comes in. Their free fuel and hydration planner builds you a personalized strategy for the exact conditions you'll be racing in. And in their case study database, you can filter by heat and humidity and see how athletes fueled and hydrated to perform at their best in Chattanooga-like conditions. Then their products let you execute. Their drink mix and electrolyte tablets, sachets, and capsules make it easy to consume an appropriate amount of fluid and electrolytes matched to how much sodium you lose in your sweat. Head to precisionfuelhydration.com and use the code TTS2026 to get 15% off your first order. Let's move on to the next study then. So I'll choose my first one here. I'll go with one on strength training. This one was called Heavy Strength Training Effects on Physiological Determinants of Endurance Cyclist Performance, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis by Janos Lagos and colleagues, so Spanish group. And basically, they said actually in their paper that it was the first meta-analysis that looked exclusively at heavy strength training's impact on cycling performance, which I sort of was shocked to see if that was correct. And because they basically said that there are lots of meta-analysis on mixed endurance sports performance and strength training. So you took cyclists and runners and triathletes and all of that, but they were the first one to do it with only cyclists. I haven't fact-checked that, but I assume that they're correct since they wrote it and it passed through peer review. But anyway, so what they did was it was classic meta-analysis. Heavy strength training implied here at least 80% of one rep maximum. Basically, they also translated that to around 7 rep maximum. So something that you can lift for like 7 times, that's around that level, apparently. And they did for outcome measures, they used VO2 max, threshold, maximum metabolic steady state, gross efficiency or different measures of efficiency. They used peak power output and also anaerobic capacity, which was usually sort of the 30-second power in a Wingate test, and cycling performance, so time trial performance or time to exhaustion performance. They found 17 studies to include with 262 participants, 60 females. And what they found was that pretty expected. It was something that has been found similarly in other studies before, but no effect on VO2 max or threshold or anaerobic capacity, but moderate effects on time trial or cycling performance, so time trials and time to exhaustion test, and on anaerobic power, which was basically peak power output, so sort of 1 to 5 second power, and also a small effect on cycling efficiency, which they speculated contributed to the cycling performance improvement. And that was sort of the main gist of it. Thoughts so far on that, Gabriele?
Yeah, no, I think it's a great study. I think as you said, it's the first meta-analysis. So reanalyzing all the raw data of the past and aggregating them, the data of the past about that topic, because there are some narrative review on the topic. So basically just discussing generally the results, but not directly analyzing them. And I think this study just confirms something that many different single training studies suggested on the topic. So that strength training works, basically.
Yeah. They also had some good recommendations. So they looked at things like how long should the program be? How often should you strength train and so on? So they then provided some recommendations, simple recommendations based on that, and which I found quite helpful. So for example, a typical recommendation would be to do at least an 8-week period of 2 strength sessions per week. And you can then maintain the gains for up to 13 weeks with just 1 session per week. Or alternatively, you can also maintain those gains for 6 to 8 weeks of no strength training. So that was quite useful findings. And in terms of what the sessions should contain, what exercises to do, they've recommended, again, based on these individual trials that they analyzed, 4 lower body exercises in each, so including both bilateral and unilateral exercises. For example, squat, single leg press, leg curls, single leg calf raises would be some examples. And 3 to 4 sets per exercise, 2 to 3 minute rest between sets. And they said also to progressively load from 11 rep maximum to 4 rep maximum. I think that was 70%. From 1 hour, 1 RM to 90% of 1 RM. So I don't think that that was done in the actual trials they analyzed, but that was more the author's own conclusion or practical recommendation, which I think makes some sense, or at least it's not a bad recommendation per se. From a practical perspective for triathletes listening to this, I would say that maybe I would do things a little bit differently, because in a triathlon strength training program, I think there are more things that can be included. So maybe I would do a fewer of these lower leg heavy lifts, but add one or maybe two plyometric exercises. And depending on the individual athlete, there are always usually some injury prevention exercises for running that you need to do for your weak spots, so to say. They might overlap with these heavy resistance exercises, but they might also not in some cases, depending on the athlete's injury history. But basically, just taking these findings into practice, I think that you don't necessarily need to do four heavy lifts every session, at least not if you do this for longer than 8 weeks. If you do this more or less year round, then two, maybe three heavier lifts per session is what I would say is plenty, and probably I would guess that it gives you sort of similar results, although that has of course not been tested in research.
I think another topic that is always discussed around strength training for endurance sport is the logistics. So it's okay to do all this strength training, but sometimes the logistic is not is someone argue that is not optimal, especially for the maintenance period during the competition period. But I think that of course, but if you are truly looking to optimize your performance, you should look at also doing that one per week strength sessions in the gym during the competition period. I think it's something that is not so physiologically costly if you plan well the rest of your training around it. And even logistically, in 2026, you can find a lot of solutions to do it. And I think it can be very beneficial for performance. Just not doing the winter period and build a lot during that, but also doing that one session per week in the following months.
Yeah, that's the practical challenge for a lot of people. When you say that there are a lot of good tools in 2026, what can you give some examples of what you're thinking about?
I was just thinking about the logistics, that in 2026, there are plenty of gyms around the world. So
gyms are okay.
Yeah. I was not talking about like technology tools. I was it's just about logistics. Many times people is complaining about logistics, but if you planning a little bit in advance, it's not so difficult in 2026 finding barbell dumbbells to do your work even in a remote in a distant location from your home.
Yeah, I know. I thought that you might have referred to something like, because I know some people have, and I really don't know how to describe them, but there are some like equipment, and I think it's pretty expensive. Like I'm not sure. I'm just guessing here. It might be a couple thousand euros. The ones where you can do basically everything, like you can do your deadlifts and squats and things like that. And of course, like there, with some very basic tools at home, you can also you can do good a large variety of exercises. So there's always ways that you don't necessarily need machines. You don't have to do a leg press or things like that. You can do things with just some free weights that you can fit in a fairly small space. So of course not possible if you live depending on your living situation, in an apartment or things like that necessarily, but I do think that it's possible to, with a fairly limited amount of home-based equipment, you can also set things up at home, which also takes away a bit that extra commute, which is always a struggle. Speaking from personal experience, I got consistent with strength training a lot better, even though I had a gym very close to where I lived before. But I just it would be the first thing to, you know, that you skip when you get a bit stressed and you don't feel that you have time, because you have to go 5 minutes to the gym. But when you can do it at home, like it just removes a psychological barrier to entry, basically.
Yeah, I think it's just a habit. So Yeah, I think it's not if you want truly do it, you find a way not so difficult in 2026. And I saw the tool that you suggested is like a portable one with rows, right?
Yeah.
I don't have experience, but I think it's
it's like a handle basically. You pull a handle, and I guess it's some kind of it's attached to some kind of resistance that pulls against the handle. So I might find an example of that and put it in the show notes for this episode.
I saw some very, very popular worldwide influencer, not related to endurance sports, but related to gym and strength training, using it. And but I don't have experience, I can speak for it, but looking from outside, it seems nice.
I actually know somebody who thought it was a really nice tool. So who is a very experienced strength training, very experienced with strength training, and he liked it. I have a couple more quick notes on this before we move on to the next study. So one thing that was interesting as well was that they analyzed the effect of whether there was more effects for example, athletes depending on muscle mass or age or sex or I think some other moderating factors maybe, but basically they didn't find any such factors, which I found interesting because personally, anecdotally, I tend to think that I see better results in athletes with lower muscle mass in general. So that might be female athletes or smaller male athletes or even older athletes that have started to experience some muscle atrophy. They didn't find any evidence of that in this meta-analysis at least. So yeah, that was interesting. And then the other thing, final note from my side, I guess, was that if for people that are interested in the physiology and the mechanisms behind the potential behind the cycling performance improvement, there was a great figure in this paper, figure 5, which had all of these sort of mechanisms and how they might impact each other and arrows going everywhere. But it was a really cool figure 5, and there was an open access version to this paper. So all of these studies, of course, we'll link to in the show notes. So figure 5 in this paper, I would recommend go and have a look at if you're interested in that sort of thing.
Yeah. I think it's very interesting, like the physiological determinants of improved endurance performance by strength training. And yeah, basically, it's more about structural and neuromuscular adaptations rather than metabolic ones. So,
yeah, exactly.
I think this is the main thing, and I think it's not completely clear which neuromuscular adaptations are behind this. There are many speculations, but it's really interesting. So, how neuromuscular improvements improve in turn efficiency? I think it's very interesting. Like, better muscle recruitment, but linked to what, you know, different percentage or kind of muscle fiber recruited, or different pedaling patterns, like pedaling technique, because one very interesting study show that pedaling technique is related to cycling efficiency, especially reducing the dead sides of the pedal revolution. And I think it's by Bent Ronestad, one very interesting study about strength training and cycling performance show that the peak torque after strength training was achieved earlier in the pedaling revolution. So this can be a very interesting link between strength training, improved efficiency, and improved cycling performance.
Yeah. Because they talked about this in this meta-analysis as well, that was one of the discussion points, that when peak torque happens earlier in the pedaling cycle, then the rest of the pedaling cycle, you have that phase of the contraction, the blood flow can potentially increase, which would potentially lead to lead to better performance or better efficiency. I don't know if they connected to efficiency or performance directly. But yeah, there's lots of speculation. Maybe, yeah. That, I mean, I think for sure muscle recruitment in some ways is involved. But yeah, there's still some gaps in the knowledge there. Let's move on to your second study that you've selected.
I think this is the big one. So I think this is one study that I took a long time to read it all because it's very long, but I think it's worth, and it will be a seminal study in the future, maybe one of the most cited, because basically is a super big review, again by a Norwegian group led by Molman. Again, I don't know if it is the right pronunciation, but basically they retrospective analyzed, we can say, all endurance training studies about improvements in VO2max capillarization, muscle capillarization, and mitochondria adaptations. And I say all because it's 50 years of analysis in total. I think it's until 2024 was the last year considered. And in total, it was something like 500 training studies, so single training studies analyzed, and 6,000 participants, which is crazy. So it's a big data analysis. And so the question that they asked themselves was, how low and high intensity training affect differently or similarly VO2max mitochondria and capillarization? So I think it is a hot topic, maybe not in high level endurance sports, but in social media it's crazy, this topic, like what is better, zone 2 low intensity or heat training for not just for performance but even for longevity, which is our topic right now. But I think the study confirmed that the question is ill-conceived if one is better than the other. And I think we can take three main takeaways from this study, maybe four. So the first one, which I think is really, really interesting, something that many people already know, but many people fall on this point, is that you can get very similar aerobic adaptations with both low and high intensity training. So it's not that. So they showed improved VO2max, improved mitochondria adaptations and capillarization, both with low intensity training and high intensity training. So it's not that you improved your mitochondria with zone 2 and you improved your VO2max with VO2max work, but all converge to the similar aerobic phenotype. I think, I don't know what you think, but I think this is a great point that many people, because of social media, I say propaganda or whatever, like the magic bullet or whatever, sometimes is confused on social media.
Absolutely. Yeah. And did you mention, did I miss it, but did you say that they also look at sprint, not just high intensity interval training, but also sprint interval training? So
yeah,
basically
yeah, yeah.
20 to 30 second sprints as well.
Yeah.
So and even there you had, in many cases at least, not in all cases, but in many cases, very, very similar adaptation.
Yeah, 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 yeah. You said, well, maybe it's better to clarify this for the other points. So they, to classify low, high, the various intensity, they choose three different groups or kind of training, low intensity, below the second, not the first in this analysis, so below the second threshold. High intensity training was above the second threshold. And then, as you said, there was a third analysis about sprint training, so short, like I think it was up to, I don't know, 20 or 30 seconds maximal or submaximal efforts with quite long recoveries. So not the like the VO2max short intervals, but sprint and the longer recovery than the active part. But again, as you said, they found that you can get a VO2max improvement and mitochondria adaptations even with sprint training, which is yeah. Crazy if you think about it. It is known in the scientific community, but if you just consider specificity of adaptations blindly, is quite interesting. And I think corollary to the first point is that sometimes, again, in social media, you read something like, okay, this study showed this, but well-trained athlete would respond differently. So different fitness influenced the response, but it was not the case in this super analysis. So basically, all the trend that we discussed now and all the trends that we are going to discuss were confirmed in completely untrained and trained participants. So they were not professional in the analysis, but like the 30 view to max guys showed a similar trends to the 55-60 view to max guys in the analysis.
Yeah. Were there, because this one, just for listeners, I have actually not read this one in full. I told you, Gabriele, before that I would ask you questions here. You have to fill me in. But where did the people with lower VO2 max, did they see bigger gains than the people that were more well-trained for a similar amount of training? Or was that something that was looked at all?
Yeah, so they improved. So lower the fitness, bigger the improvement in aerobic markers.
Right, yeah.
But the trends, the general trends we are discussing about, so like no specificity of adaptations between different intensities. And more interestingly, the other points that we are going to see now were reproducible on different fitness level guys.
Yeah, yeah. So what was your third of the main points then that you wanted to highlight?
Yeah, I would say the second, because I think the first was like fourth and the corollary.
That was a corollary.
So I think the second point is that, okay, so the authors asked, what are the differences in adaptations if we standardize per unit of time? So let's say if you train 1 hour at low intensity and if you train 1 hour at high intensity, what is the difference? This was the question. And unsurprisingly, the results was that the higher the intensity, the higher the benefit of aerobic adaptation. So I think it is, again, it's interesting. It's quite intuitive, but interesting because, again, it's not that if you train 1 hour in zone two, you will improve more your mitochondria if you train 1 hour at high intensity. So this is something that is misconceived on social media and I would say fitness influencer.
Yeah, it all goes in trends because maybe that was more about 15-20 years ago.
Yeah.
High intensity training was really big, and exactly. And then zone two is now the really big thing. I think before that we had, maybe it started about 10 years ago or so, the whole polarized training and 80-20 and all of that. And that has led to the current big trend, which I think is the zone two trend. But this is data that clearly shows that you have to make different choices if you have less time, which I think, I think it's very intuitive anyway. But this is pretty interesting data to have as one point of evidence for that.
Yeah. So I think that we don't have to fall in the opposite way as you were saying. Like, okay, if per unit of time, higher the intensity, better the outcome. We should do all as much as high intensity we can. But it's not the case because the amount of low intensity that is doable per week, per microcycle, whatever, is much higher because less stressful and less strain. So, intrinsically for unit of time is not better, but is the only way to complement the limited amount of powerful but limited amount of high intensity training that you can do within a microcycle without accumulating too much stress and strain. So, it's better for you per unit of time, but is limited. So again, the answer is pyramidal and polarized, as we were saying. And but I think this suggests that how much percentage of low intensity you should do is related to the total your total volume. So the lower your total volume, the less percentage should be given to low intensity. Again, it should be the major part of the training volume, but less than if you train 10 hours compared to 20 hours per week.
Yeah, maybe. But if you think about the first study that you talked about, the reproducibility, where they had great improvements for 8 weeks on average, they did, what percentage would they have had? Because they did 2 hours and 15 minutes of training. And I wanted to say it was 36 plus 32 minutes plus 20 minutes. They did slightly more than 50% at either sort of a moderate to high intensity in the heavy to severe domain. So, But that's of course a very, very extreme example with only two hours, 15 minutes of training per week. But yeah, with that low training volume, they didn't even need to do the majority of their training at a low intensity. They were able to, even with not having a big base, and there were some dropouts, but I don't think it was an unreasonable amount of dropouts compared to normal studies. I think it seemed normal when I read that.
Yeah. I think that.
Anyway, your next main point from this study, Dan?
Yeah, I think this is the third one and the last one, but maybe the most interesting is the. Okay, so you obtain more adaptations per unit of time with high intensity, but you can compensate with a higher volume of low intensity these gains, and you can equal. But the third question is, what about the time course of adaptation? So if we consider longer time frame than they usually studied 2, 4, or 6 weeks of traditional training studies, so what is the time course? 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 10 weeks, 20 weeks? And I think this is really, really, really interesting. So basically, in the first weeks, so let's say 2, 4, 6 weeks, again, the higher the intensity, the higher the gains. So in 2 weeks or 4 weeks, you can improve very fast with high intensity training. But the interesting point was that it seems like sprint, especially sprint training, but possibly even high intensity training, plateau earlier than low intensity in adaptations. And was about, in the study was about 6 weeks or 4 weeks for the sprint and 15 weeks for the high intensity, the plateau. But let's look at the trend, because there is not the exact number or response. When you look at a big analysis, it's difficult to give a specific number, but that's the point. And my takeaway from this is that it's just as that. So if you want to play the long game and improve it in the long run, you should do a large percentage of low intensity training, and high intensity training, you should foster it in specific time of the year or the periodization, to have the most of this stressful but powerful arm, which makes you improve fast but plateau earlier than low intensity training.
What is your opinion on, so this, we're talking about peripheral factors here when we're talking about the mitochondria and we're talking about the capillaries, but VO2 max, for example, there are some studies that seem to indicate that, I mean, that the majority of the improvement in VO2 max that you make are related to your stroke volume. So do you think that when we look at this data, that is all, how do you think that basically this data would, do the same conclusions apply when you start to look at central factors as well, like stroke volume, for example?
I think that we have VO2 max in this analysis, and I think so stroke volume.
Yeah, that's true. We have VO2 max directly. That is true.
Yeah. So stroke volume is the main factor which is related to VO2 max. And so if we look at VO2 max values, we can assume similar trends for stroke volume in my point of view.
Yeah. Yeah, good. Let me see if I had any more questions about this. The time course was something that I wrote down that I think I found really interesting. One thing that they said as well from my brief look through the study was that training frequency seemed to have a positive impact on the improvement in most or all of these, all the variables that they measured. So I think they looked at 2 times a week to 4 times a week to 6 times a week of training. So maybe nothing crazy high in terms of frequency, at least for triathletes, but maybe for some single sport athletes listening, cyclists and runners that might be training 3 times a week, that would be a good data point that would imply that, yeah, maybe adding, even if it's something fairly short, adding a bit more frequency could be beneficial.
Yeah. I think it's interesting point, and I think that I think related to this, I'm interested. I think that there are no data on this, but if you increase also the frequency during the day, like doing the double sessions, what is the outcome compared to only one? So not just at weekly level, but at daily level. There are studies that show that you can have less stress and strain the day after if you split the sessions, but there are no data on human on adaptations. So I think it's really interesting also. Train 2 times 1 hour per day or just 2 hours in one day.
Yeah. Shall we move on to the final study for today, to my second one?
Yeah.
So this one is called Elite Aerobic Endurance Performance. Is it really related to lactate threshold expressed relative to peak oxygen uptake? So another long title. It's another one from Norway. I think 3 of our studies here today were from Norway. This one is by Johansen and colleagues. And they had 292 people in their study. This was actually, basically this was labeled a brief report. So it wasn't, they took data that they had from athletes that they had already tested in different studies that had already been done and published elsewhere. So this one was quite short, actually, if people want to read it. But what they wanted to investigate there, they had all this test data from a lot of good athletes. They had 71 elite athletes, 158 national level athletes, and 63 regional level athletes. So those would be more sort of good amateur athletes. And this included runners, cyclists, and cross-country skiers. And they wanted to see whether the lactate threshold as a percentage of VO2 max or VO2 peak, if that was different between these three groups of elite national level and regional level athletes. And they found that that was not the case. So on average, lactate threshold for all of these ended up being around 80%, 79 to 80%. But there was quite a large range. So in all of these groups, you had some people where it was at 90% of VO2 max and some people where it was at 70% or so. So a large range, but with the same average between the groups. But then the big difference was that the VO2 max itself was quite different between the three groups. 71 on average for the national level, elite athletes, 66 for the national level athletes and 58 for the regional athletes. And, I don't know if I said this. Did I say this already? But the study included 212 male athletes and 80 female athletes. So that was the main thing, the main point of this study, because there has been this sort of premise that one of the key determinants of endurance performance in the classic model is fractional utilization at lactate threshold. But I think that you might know better. But I think that that came from studies in very homogeneous groups, so all elite athletes, and where it makes sense that would be a really key factor. When everybody already has a pretty high VO2 max, then the percentage of VO2 max for threshold becomes really important. But when we're looking at a broader scale, then that's no longer necessarily the case, and then it ends up not mattering so much, and the VO2 max itself is what is a bigger the big separator of these different groups. And of course, speed at lactate threshold, if we're talking about running, or power at lactate threshold, if we're talking about cycling, was very different between the groups. But speed or power at lactate threshold was strongly dependent on VO2 max and exercise economy. So basically it moved directly with those. And another point that these authors made as well, which was quite interesting, was that according to the studies they cited anyway, different training interventions have not found it to be that easy to change where your lactate threshold is as a percentage of VO2 max through training. So that was something that I hadn't really seen in the literature before. But yeah, that was those were the main findings from this study, I think. And I think it basically, for me, the thing to drive home, because I think especially at least among triathletes, not so sure if it's the same among cyclists, but among triathletes, I think sometimes we underestimate VO2 max and how important it is. And I've heard people say things like, you know, VO2 max doesn't matter when you do Ironman or things like that. And I think it very much matters. Regardless of the distance, and this was a nice study that showed that with a good data set of athletes.
Yeah. I think this is another social media trend, like underestimating VO2 max. Just because in the past, a lot of attention, early research in exercise physiology was about VO2 max. And then it was found that it is not nothing. It was not all about VO2 max.
Not everything, yeah.
It's not everything about VO2 max, but this doesn't mean that VO2 max is not king. So also in my experience with metabolic heart data with cyclists, of course, if it's critical power and power at threshold is more... is a better marker, but because there is power linked at that marker. But if you just look at physiology, so VO2 max, fractional utilization of VO2 max at threshold and economy, VO2 max is by far the most important factor. And so also you can read a lot about if you have a lower VO2 max, this doesn't mean that you can be a professional athlete, but in my experience with road cyclists, maximum you can counter I would say maximum 5-7 point higher VO2 max, not a larger difference. So for example, if you have 75, you can compete up to someone like 80-82, but if you have like 68, you will never be able to compensate against a guy with 80 VO2 max with a better economy and fractional utilization. This is in my empirical experience, because also they can vary, but not that much like as VO2 max, exercise economy and fractional utilization.
Yeah, no, I love that those sorts of empirical experience based rules of thumb. That's a really really useful one. And it makes a lot of sense. Is there something else on this study that I wanted to mention? Just looking through my notes. I guess they also talked a bit about economy and highlighted that yes, economy is also very important. Even though it wasn't the main the main focus here was really the lactate threshold as percentage of VO2 max. But economy is of course very important. And that's where strength training, like we talked about in the first study, also comes in. Like that's one of the known ways for both cycling and running that you can improve economy or gross efficiency in cycling. So that one is one not to forget as well. Because with economy you don't have so many options. Like definitely doing just a lot of volume improves economy, and strength training does, but what else does? Like I don't know, maybe some sprints on the bike, some strides on the run. There's not so much data on that. Maybe there is. What do you have any thoughts on economy?
Yeah, but I think it's the same as we spoke for. Again, I think there is large overlapping of across all the intensity and training modalities, across all the endurance determinants. So you can improve with low intensity, you can improve both VO2 max, fractional utilization, and economy. With high intensity, you can improve VO2 max, fractional utilization, and economy. There is not such like a magic bullet of specificity. I think it's just about finding the best way to combine them in the microcycle and microcycle based on the individual athlete. But there is not like research that if you train in that way, you will... Yeah, strength training is one thing, but on the bike... Or like speaking just about endurance, there is no like the workout for efficiency or the workout for VO2 max or the workout for fractional utilization.
Yeah. One more thing on VO2 max that I want to say actually is that now I was speaking lyrically about VO2 max and how important it is. I actually don't think it's important to know your VO2 max. Maybe if you're a professional athlete, it becomes a bit more interesting. But even then, I don't really think it's important. What's important is to have a good VO2 max, and you can you can understand if you have a good VO2 max or not quite well by understanding where is your 5-minute power on the bike, or even doing a ramp test. A lot of the indoor cycling platforms have ramp tests included. Like if you're on Ruby, for example, you can do a ramp test. And I don't think that ramp tests are good to determine your FTP or your threshold. But if you change your performance in a ramp test, that's usually correlated with a change in VO2 max. We've had past guests on the show. Michael Rosenblatt, for example, has talked about that. And so if you, for example, in a training block, improve your ramp test performance, then that's likely due to a pretty similar change in VO2 max. So it can be a good way to, if you have no clue of where you stand on that front, you can try a ramp test. But with a 5-minute power test, there are also formulas that you can use to estimate it that have been investigated in the literature. Of course, your economies or gross efficiency is not known, but it also is usually within a certain level of athlete, it doesn't change so much so that you can get at least a decent estimate of where your VO2 max is based on those formulas. Maybe if I remember, I'll put that in the show notes. I'll make a note here. Sorry, just writing that down. But yeah, the one thing that I think is not good is the VO2 max estimates that you get from your Garmin or things like that, because they, for whatever reason, they chosen to include heart rate in those algorithms, which doesn't make any sense to me why it's included. That's at least my understanding, because they used to have first beat algorithms, and I read some white papers from first beat where that was said to be the case. So that's not something that I would pay too much attention to.
Yeah, I think that there is some. I think it depends on the unit and the brand. But I think there is some study with heart rate too. But the best estimation is with a 5-minute power. Again, as you and you can get one good estimation point, but for longitudinal changes, I think it can be an indication. But also you could improve your 5-minute thanks to your improved W prime or anaerobic reserve and not your VO2 max. And I think a little bit the same for the incremental ramp test, especially if the design of the test is with shorter steps, like 30 seconds, 1 minute, you can go much higher just because you improved your W prime and not truly your VO2 max. So I think it depends on the design test of the ramp test, but yeah, generally you can have a good idea of your VO2 max based on your 5-minute power. And yeah, there is no, like, especially for already trained athletes, there is no a big rationale to directly measure your VO2 max for training implication. It's not that if you measure your VO2 max, you have an information of how to structure your training based on your individual VO2 max. I think it's mainly about curiosity, VO2 max.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I don't think there's a, I can't think of a reason to pay for a test in a lab to figure out your VO2 max for any amateur athlete, really. I think that's all I had on this study. Do you have any other thoughts or comments on it?
No. Yeah, maybe just one point about what you just said. I think that for lab metabolic heart test, fractional utilization, that's maybe can be a little bit more interesting for training. But yeah, not truly just.
I must say I haven't read the studies that were referenced in this paper that claimed that it's not easy, that it not doesn't respond so easily to training. I'd be curious to read them. But I think it of course does respond to training anecdotally, because we see athletes athletes tend to reach, if you train from when you're pretty young, you tend to reach your maximum VO2 max when you're maybe in your mid 20s or even early 20s or sometimes late 20s, but you can still improve performance beyond that. So part of that is economy, but part of that might also be fractional utilization. So yeah, I think that's a good point that in practical terms, that probably can make sense. And I think economy as well, because there are things that you can do to improve that. Both on the bike and the run, at least to figure out if you're an outlier, negatively speaking, I think it that's maybe something if you're trying to troubleshoot your performance, you're not really understanding something is not going as you expected, or you're not performing the way that you would expect, then maybe economy is something to look into. And one scenario where I would pay for a test is if you have two pairs of super shoes that you want to compare, or even three of them. Like this can be worth it for sure to figure out what is the fastest shoe for you that you are the most economical in.
Yeah. I was saying that. Yeah. Again. Yeah. That's a good thing. Like. Yeah. Comparing technologies, the effect of different technologies on economy on a lab test can be interesting. That can be nice also for some bike adjustment, like what equipment and position. But I think that fractional utilization can be interesting also to because there is another recent paper that showed that. You can possibly pick your optimal high intensity session based on your fractional utilization of U2 max. So basically, is the lower you have your fractional utilization of U2 max, you should pick. I say you should pick short intermittent U2 max intervals to maintain a high fraction U2 max during the heat session. Conversely. If your fractional utilization of U2 max is high, so at a high percentage of U2 max at the threshold, the long intervals, like the 4 minutes interval, can permit you better, at least as much as the short formats, to maintain a high percentage of U2 max during the heat session. So to individualize each session's format based on the fractional utilization of U2 max, there is a very nice, I suggested this, but the data are from a recent paper, again, from the same Norwegian guys of the first study. So Odden and there was Ronestad in the research group. It's very interesting, I think.
I'll read it, yeah. Yeah, that is quite interesting data for sure. And I don't think, unfortunately, it's very easy to estimate or guess what your fractional utilization of VO2 max is. Do you think that is something that... could you estimate that with field testing if you don't have a lab available?
It was something that I asked myself after reading the paper. Okay, but with the athletes, without visiting a lab, can I have this data to individualize its sessions? And I would say generally yes, but not specifically. So the 5 minute power can be considered the power at VO2 max, or the 6 minute power can be considered the power at VO2 max. Then you can have your critical power, and you say that the second threshold, and then you do a ratio between the two powers number, the five and the critical power and the 5-6 minutes. But that percentage will not be the same as the real fractional utilization of U2 max. So it can be useful to compare different athletes, but not to have the absolute number, you know.
No, this is a trick that only works for coaches. Like I have tons of data with this exact, I have these exact numbers for a lot of athletes, so I can go and look at all of them and see what is the normal distribution of that. There's probably a normal distribution, but for an individual athlete, unfortunately, that's very hard because you can do that math and you get your number, but you don't really know if that is high or low, or what does that mean, unless you go and ask all your friends, which you could do. You can ask your friends, you can get the data from everybody in your cycling club or your triathlon club
because the point is that you don't know if the 5 minute and 6 minute power, how much is truly the power at VO2 max, or how much is anaerobic reserve, that power. You can't really know that. So I think it just can be a rule of thumb comparing different athletes, but not to have the unique information about your truly fractional utilization and to use it for that. So my short answer is no.
Okay, maybe if I'm going to overcomplicate it even more, what if we, in addition to a 5 minute and a 20 minute time trial, we do a 1 minute time trial or 1 to 2 minute time trial, and we can then categorize our athletes based on the 1 to 2 minute time trial as likely to have high, medium, or low W prime or glycolytic capacity. And then based on that, if we can then do a normal distribution for each of those three categories, that would then be our fractional utilization of the critical power divided by by VO2 max power. So
But
we're probably overcomplicating things way too much now at this point.
Yeah, but I think if someone who is doing research is listening to that, just do that. If you have big data, model from power meter data and compare to fractional utilization data of VO2 max test, do some linear regression or whatever, and then just give the equation, and we can work on that on the feed without attending a lab.
Yes, that is a great research project for sure. And we would be thankful. Gabriele, tell listeners where they can what you're up to with Knowledge is What and where people can find you.
Yeah. So again, as you said in the introduction, on Instagram, you can find a lot of free informations. Basically, every day we publish something. While on the Substack platform, there is a small fee, I think it's 5 or 6 euros per month, and you can find in depth as a level of analysis and practical implication analysis of recent and not recent studies. And so Instagram and Substack and Knowledge is What.
Brilliant. Yep. And listeners, remember to check out the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com. This will be episode 705. Yeah, 705. So scientifictriathlon.com/TTS705. I'll put all the links to the papers there. I believe they are all open access, so you'll be able to get them. And of course, the formula for VO2 max I'll try to put there as well. Also, remember to support our sponsors, Ruby, Effortless Swimming, and Precision Fluid Hydration. A quick note for European listeners that Effortless Swimming should, by the time you hear this, be have distribution available in Europe, which they haven't had until now. So if you've had to wait here in Europe for getting your goggles from Effortless Swimming, now is the time to shop their goggles. If it's not available yet, it will be within a few days, really. So yeah, stay tuned for that. And finally, if you're interested in coaching or training plans, you can find all the information about that as well on scientifictriathlon.com. And with that, thank you everybody for listening. And Gabriele, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you. Bye-bye.